Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Today my guest is Gioia Timpanelli. She's the author of two novellas of Sicily called Sometimes the Soul, which has been published in paperback by Vintage. It's a beautiful book, made particularly beautiful by the fact that you can tell, even if you didn't know it, that Gioia Timpanelli is a professional storyteller. And so the books are full of all of the inviting gestures of tale-telling, the formulas to begin a story, the way of thickening and complicating the plot, and the ways of ending a story. This interview is part of Women Writing in the Imagination, our ongoing series of conversations with nine prominent women artists at the beginning of the 21st century. And I thought I'd begin by asking you why it is that the storyteller, the crone, is often a woman figure. What is the relation between women and stories?
I think that women, in general, have been the keepers of the lore, have been trying all their life to deal with the complicated world that they have to live in for many, many reasons. We all know the cultural, historical, social. And they have not left the imaginative world or the world of what later becomes literature. And as Penelope Fitzgerald just recently said, she started writing novels because it was not a place where it was fair. It was a place where women could write and publish and succeed in this field. And I think that women found that they could keep the imagination, which they already had, going by telling the stories. Also, they were the keepers of the hearth. And the children and the adults, because the community came to hear stories. And I think they were just good at it. They were good at putting those two things together, the story and the imaginative world.
Now, as I read Sometimes the Soul, particularly the first novella in it called A Knot of Tears, I noticed that there are characters more or less off stage who are analysts of folk tales. And I wondered, do you yourself study like Vladimir Propp and those people who have developed what they consider to be the essence, yes, yes, of a folk tale?
Yeah. Oh, yes. I've been telling stories for a number of years, and I started out in the world of looking, really, studying. I love studying, and I love ways of knowing. So, yes, I have read an awful lot of material about that, a great deal. Also, medieval lit was my graduate degree, English medieval lit. And that is filled with stories, and also because you have to do research. And I've done a lot of research. Yes, so the answer is I love doing that.
Because what I noticed is that the first of the novellas, A Knot of Tears, is organized by the days of the week. And so it's very much a story that rebegins and rebegins. It's a story of sequence. Mm-hmm. Whereas the second novella, which is based on Beauty and the Beast, is a seasonal narrative. Mm-hmm. And it seems to be less about constantly re-beginning. Mm-hmm. It's more about cycles and the mm-hmm. fullness of time and a gradual transformation. And I wondered, is there a structure inherent mm-hmm. in mm-hmm. each of these kinds of tales? Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's quite right. The second story, because it was my meditation on Beauty and the Beast, I said, now these stories are way beyond what they look like. I mean, they just seem simple, but they're, you know, as simple as something in the bread box that you didn't expect. These are complicated, really beautiful little seeds of understanding. So when I dealt with Beauty and the Beast and I did the meditation on it, I mean, I started sitting down, what is this? And I didn't think it through exactly. What I did is I wrote it through. And the writing was the exciting part to me. And of course, since the Beast in the Beauty and the Beast is very involved with nature, He is the one of nature, the god of nature, whatever you call him. He's the in folklore, it would be the animal husband, the way there are bride, animal brides and star brides, depending upon the culture. He would be that. And so, of course, I knew he was very involved with, remember, he's involved with the rose bush.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And when the father picks the rose, he appears. Because, of course, he's from that world. He's from the world of vegetation. He's very ancient. He's very old. So it seemed so right as I was writing this that it would deal with the beauty of the seasons and the changing, and also this young girl's heart flowering and learning and trying to actually challenge herself. She's the kind of person who doesn't fall into things, but rather really observes, hears, and makes them touch her. She's one of those people given to understanding.
Mm-hmm. Now, my teacher, John Barth, was given to what he called the reorchestration of classic stories.
Mm-hmm.
He would retell Scheherazade, mm-hmm. examining the frame of the storytelling. He retold the story of Perseus. He retold the story of Oedipus Rex in The Gyroscope Boy. And he became very interested in the shape of the stories themselves, almost as if he was studying them as if they were lessons in proportion. And I sensed in
the, I love that.
Yeah. It was yeah. fascinating to me because he truly felt, and I found this in your work, although less self-consciously, he truly felt that the Fibonacci series, for instance, was essential to the nature of the shaping of a story.
How funny that you should mention that. You know, in the second story, there it is, the Fibonacci series.
And in fact, in that second story, it's a library that's growing.
Yes.
First there's one book.
Yes.
Then another one, so that there are two. The Fibonacci series is generated by adding the numbers together. So 2 plus 1 is 3. 3 plus 2 is 5.
Yes, they augment incredibly wildly.
Yes, a huge library would be the result of books grown on a Fibonacci series.
Yes.
But I sense that the stories themselves, that you have an interest in the mathematics of storytelling. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that?
Well, you know, mathematics, part of the world, has always been part of the imaginative world and the intuitive world. So there's a great deal of information involved, but there's also something that one grasps from it. If you look at a sunflower, if you look at the Guggenheim Museum, there's a Fibonacci series at work.
Mm-hmm.
You look at the tremendous augmenting in nature, and you see them as relations and as movement, too, because as they move and they get larger and larger, you get a wilder and wilder thing. So the Fibonacci series is something that describes nature. So it's describing – see, we tend to categorize and separate life, but actually the integral understanding of – I suspect by people who really know math, see that these are things they discover and find in the world like some great explorer, and that it's all around us the way the Fibonacci series is.
Yes. In fact, what we discover is that it's not just the seeds of the sunflower and the spiral whorl that forms, that is the position of those seeds, but also the spiral nebula, that everywhere in nature there are implicit mathematical structures, and they're rarely the squares and triangles that mathematicians have evoked for senses of area. Rather, they are spiraled.
That's exactly the way stories are.
Yes, exactly. That story, the math of stories is as much of the natural world.
Mm-hmm.
We're not talking about tough stuff here.
No.
We're talking about the sense that nature tells us how to tell a story.
As a matter of fact, the fact that I was just talking about this yesterday. See, the old stories are about images, sequential images. And when you get a sequential image, you can't help – like language. Language is itself a sequence. You notice what happened when James Joyce tried to really break that in his own way, because he made the image and the poetry something more that was going to be dependent upon – not the linguistic linear language, subject, verb, object. He was going to break that. Well, you go so far before you need a lot of help, but still it's there. The poetry's there. Poetry loves to do that. It loves to take that kind of essence. Story follows image, and it follows because of language. It tries to give some coherent understanding. However, intrinsic in it is something as mysterious as a spiral. You take a story that's simple, that everybody knows. You hear it at 10, you hear one story. You hear it at 15, you hear another. You hear it at 20, at 25, same story. I don't mean you should change it. I mean, just it's because within us is the spiral itself. So the story has the seed that can allow the images to grow, change, and move wherever we are in the specific. So it's about something quite marvelous.
I'm speaking to Gioia Timpanelli, whose collection of novellas, Sometimes the Soul, is published by Vintage. My sense is that in your work, there is a derivation from the ancient arts of storytelling. That is to say, each sequence seems to have its implicit buried moral as you move along. And there is a kind of poetry of emblem, an image to interpret as you read. They're very beautifully, lustrously worded. When in the first story, for instance, it's a phrase that recurs in both stories, when a parrot is freed and comes to the house, a cage is found for him, he, this parrot, will enable the telling of stories, and the old servant says, when God closes a door, he opens a window.
That's an old Sicilian phrase. When God closes one door, he opens another.
Right.
It opens another.
It reappears, the phrase, in the next story. It's a common enough phrase, but that these vignettes often lead to the drawing of an aphorism or a moral summing up, or the way the stories end, you know, they lived happily ever after, we're still looking for the right work for us.
Yes.
You know, there's very much the sense that what a story was for, that these were in some sense meant to be storage houses of wisdom, is very much in your work.
Yes. And as a matter of fact, the fact that they are frames, that they begin with aesthetic framing, once upon a time they lived happily ever after, means that what we have in the middle is absolutely eternity. These are things that are not meant to be laden only with history, with the temporal things of our lives, even culture, even though they are culture stories, but not they're temporally not meant to stay there. They're meant to be eternal. They're meant to be looked at as little wisdoms so that we can reinterpret, rethink, refigure. And the reason they're within these frames is so that we can say they lived happily ever after. Nobody's ever promised in one of these stories that we were going to live happily ever after.
They say about the fairy tales that they were of the hearth, that the women would tell them, and that the scholars of fairy tales, those who would go around collecting them, tended to be men. But what I see in your work is a fusion of the telling of the tale and the collecting of the tale simultaneously, the placing it within a galaxy of similar such stories.
That's exactly right. The interesting thing about folklore is that, well, for example, I'll just give a little detail. Cinderella was collected by the head of the Folklore Society, who was a woman, 1898, Marion Rolfe Cox. You can get this tome in any university library, good library. And in it, she collected 374, I think, variants of Cinderella and Cinderlad. These things are not gender specific. Often they are motifs that are suitable for male or female or male. As they say in the old Latin thing, sive mas, sive femina. Sive mas, sive femina. And they were collected by Marion Rolfe Cox, and her informants came back, men and women, from all over the world, women and men from everywhere, with these motifs of Cinderella and Cinderlad stories. And she stopped at 374, 394, something of that sort, because it could have gone on and on and on. There were so many motifs from all around the world. And women did come back with them. There were many folklore scholars who were women. It was something that they came to. They were even among the rewriters, and the literary fairy tale was written, Madame d'Aunoy. Many of the women wrote them as well. So it's an interesting little topic here.
Well, it is, in fact, my next subject, because those French stories, some of them were collected by Marina Warner, and she called them wonder tales. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, your background is in the Sicilian story. Mm-hmm. What is the name for them there?
We call them favole, fiabe, conti, I conti, in Sicilian itself. Sicilian is its own language. And my family, well, anyway, I was
no,
going to say.
Me.
Well, my mother's people heard them as children as actual folk tales, fairy tales, folk tales, really. My father's family, with whom I grew up, they mostly, it was the literary tale in my father's family, mm-hmm. so that I was exposed to Basile and Straparola and to the Sicilian tellers of the old fables, L'Abate Mele, the Abate Mele, who wrote fabulous old stories in the 18th century. And they were stories collected. They were stories collected from the oral tradition and written very early on in Italy. Collected in Venice and in Naples. And they were, as a matter of fact, the Grimm brothers gave a lot of credit to Basile for his incredible book where they were collected centuries before.
Mm-hmm.
And our then tellers often took them also back from the literary, back to the oral tradition. So what an amazing back and forth of the written and the oral. And we were given great permission to be both honoring the oral tradition, where the story is in your own head, in your own heart, in your own self, and the literary tradition, written by someone alone and quiet in a room, and then giving it out on paper, that it was then used and collected and used again, then it goes back into the culture. So it's this wonderful play back and forth of both the written and the oral, the written and the oral. And I saw this book as being an example of taking some of the motifs and then just going with them.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not fairy tales, really. So if someone wants a fairy tale, they should go to fairy tale books. This is really fiction. But they honor, I'd say they honor the old grandparent of folk and folk tale.
You're listening to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt, and I'm talking to Gioia Timpanelli. As I looked at the cover of the vintage edition, which is a very beautiful cover, flowers that seem both real and tapestry-like simultaneously. I thought about that interest in small and delicate mm-hmm. things mm-hmm. that Edmund Burke talked about when he made a distinction between the sublime and the beautiful. The sublime was huge, mammoth, overwhelming, sea serpent-like.
Mm-hmm.
The beautiful was delicate, evanescent, miniaturized, and characterized by the feminine. When you read this essay, A Philosophical Inquiry into the Sublime and the Beautiful, it's almost hilarious because essentially he's talking about the phallic on the one hand as terrifying and the
isn't that interesting?
Yeah, and the feminine on the other hand as being acceptable,
uh-huh.
integratable.
Uh-huh.
And I noticed in this work the fitting of objects and the fitting of sentences is mm-hmm. very mosaic-like,
yes.
precise,
mm-hmm.
and extraordinarily delicate.
Well, do you remember that section where she sees the Arethusa water jug?
Mm-hmm.
I can't tell you. I remembered sitting in a hotel in Amsterdam, working on that paragraph over and over. I couldn't sleep. I mean, I'd, you know, take an hour, go have a cup of tea, I'd come back, and I sat there overlooking a beautiful canal of water and stuff, and I'd start back, because it mattered to me so much, that image. The idea that she was going to see an object in her hand, which was a water jug, which had in it a representation of the Arethusa Fountain in Sicily that one finds in Siragusa. And it's an old story told in Ovid. You can find it in many places, but Ovid is a good source. And there she's filling it with water, and it seems as though the well is filling up itself so that she's drinking from this incredibly magic thing itself, even though it's simply a cup. And it's what art does. It's what language does. It brings us, it carries us from one to another.
Now, stories, in particular literary fables, carry within them, in the tone of the telling, an idea about the implicit audience that they're addressed to. Do you have an idea of the audience for your stories?
You must know this. When I gave this final, you know, the third line edit or whatever it's called to my editor, I remember lying in bed saying to myself, now who in the world is going to read this? Why would they want to read? What is this about? I mean, art so moves me. I just do it, you know? Mm-hmm. And then I never thought about, like, oh, dear me, perhaps nobody will want to read this. So no, I must tell you, I didn't. I just wrote it because I had to. I mean, I'm one of those things that really had to happen.
I'm talking
But
more,
I didn't have an audience, I don't think. What do you mean? Do you mean something else?
I'm talking a little bit more abstractly.
Uh-huh. Oh, you mean to whom was the voice addressed? I mean, was...
Yes.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Well, I got to say that it would be more to the part that we all share. That's what I would say. I would say it's to a communal understanding that it's the kind of story where it's a surprise, but you somehow know it already. There's something in it that you can say, aha. And I think that's the place. I would say more it's the place in us that I was, I think, writing to.
Yes, because... Some would say that it's the part of the adult that is still childlike that certain stories are addressed to. Others would say that it's the part of the adult that in fact has moved beyond childhood and needs to be reminded of it, that it's not talking to a child, it's re-invoking a child.
Oh, it's not to a child. These are not stories for children, really, really, really. As a matter of fact, you know the old stories were never for children, even though they say picciriri. They were really stories for the community. And children came along and fell asleep. My great-grandmother was a teller. And the kids fell asleep. I mean, these were adults who were dreaming. This was a group dream. And fiction, of course, is something beyond that, too. It's not the same. It's the child of that, but not the same. And I would say that my stories definitely are not meant for children, but that they are meant... I don't know what they're meant for. How would I know? I mean, I write them because I'm compelled to write them. I love writing. And I'm not interested. I'm interested in the complicated simple, in the imbroglio, in the thing turned in on itself, therefore making a third meaning, a fourth meaning, a fifth. And if someone can go back to a sixth or seventh or eighth meaning, then they might be able to simplify it for themselves. But that's their task. I don't know what they're going to do with it.
Now, both of these stories involve, in a sense, a retreat from the world.
Yes.
And they both end at a point where that retreat is over.
Yes.
Beauty has allowed herself to be touched and to touch.
Yes.
The scholar Baroness in the first story is about to rejoin life, but they oddly, both of them, involve a point where sexuality is not yet acceptable in the world for various reasons. Youth in the second, disappointment of some kind not named in the first. And I wanted to ask you about the realm of the sexual in the story.
Isn't that interesting? I had a feeling you were going to ask that, because there's a lot of eros in the story. I think that for me, the eros is the thing. So that, by the way, there is some sexuality in the second story, but it's very quietly said. It's when she goes to the dance and she touches and they touch hands and they stay together for a while. There is an mm-hmm. intimation that there is in the kiss something way beyond. I mean, so she's been awakened to
yes.
something. But she is young and there's this protection of the group and of the large area. But she still is part of that. You do feel with the older woman that that isn't the real question of her life. And I think that it is a thing that I've said this, and I've had friends, women friends say, that actually it's like the motif itself, where the woman appears and the two men are interested, but frankly, she's got other things on her mind. She's really deeply interested in something else that she doesn't get caught in then. Because you feel, I don't know about you, but I feel that the young sailor is interested in her.
Mm-hmm.
She's not interested in that. Mm-hmm. Totally uninterested. And yet kind and has a kind of compassion for him. She's so grateful that he has told her the stories and that he's been willing to come in and do tell the stories and also do the work, whatever, and also be touched by what the women were doing there. So it's that soul finding. When I wrote that line, the soul is finally – let me see how I said it. At last the soul is refreshed in the sweet company it has made. So it has made company that is of its own kind, and it is not sexuality. In either case, although there is in the second some hint of it to come.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really Eros that is here. And when on Friday, I don't know if you remember the piece on Friday, it's actually to the goddess Venus. It's a little hymn to the goddess herself in a sense, because it's about the feeling in the air and what's happening in the garden of the Green Palace. May I read this paragraph?
Sure.
In the garden, the sparrows were noisy. It was the excitement of tag, catch, and voices. The cool air was shot through with sparrows. Hot sparrows, said the lady from the sea. Mm-hmm. Come, swoop, and chatter. Chee, 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 said life. Fly here, there, then turn in your place and fly in the opposite direction. Ah, life, what true lessons, said the Lady of Beauty. All mine know me by this living moment. And that's a thing to the Eros of life, whether it's the sparrows excited because there's some sexual, it's spring, I mean, there's some sexual play there, or because it's our confusion and excitement in the sexual, where we go here, there, fly in the opposite direction. We're caught by something greater than ourselves.
I've been speaking to Gioia Timpanelli, the author of Sometimes the Soul, a set of two novellas of Sicily on Sicilian themes. It's published by Vintage Books, and it's a divine pleasure to read. Thank you very much for joining me.
You're welcome, and thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Jennifer Swadek. Special production assistance from Alan Howard.
This conversation has been part of Women, Writing, and the Imagination, a special series of interviews with 9 women artists at the beginning of the 21st century.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with Book of the Mouse Podcast.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.